Welcome to Wild Utah, the podcast of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. I'm your host, Dave Pacheco. In this episode, we want to introduce you to our podcast, outlining some of our reasons for starting up. And we'll have a conversation with SUA board member Daryl Konufke about the origins and early days of SUA. In doing some research for our show, we found Daryl's name listed as a board member in SUA's newsletter starting in late 1986, just 3 years after our organization's founding. He has some fascinating insights to share with us about SUA's origins and the early days of the Utah Wilderness Movement. Before we test Daryl's memory, we want to take this opportunity to introduce you to our show. Over the past year or so, SUA staff and board members have tossed around the idea of giving our members, followers, and the general public a means to hear a deep dive into some of the current issues we're tracking. We also wanted to provide a portable platform for you to engage SUA on your own terms and on your own time. And so Wild Utah was born. In our first episode, we jumped right in by talking with Wildlands Program Director Neil Clark about the status of congressional legislation on Emery County and the Wild San Rafael Swell region. Future episodes will tackle ongoing threats to our wildlands from oil and gas development, road proliferation, the RS-2477 issue or phantom roads, chaining and large-scale vegetation removal, and the state of Utah's attempt to take over ownership of federal public lands. We'll also put a spotlight on our work to build a groundswell of support for America's Red Rock Wilderness, our efforts to diversify the wilderness movement, and discuss opportunities for you to protect the land in your own creative ways. Our Wild Utah podcast is also meant to be a permanent repository for the ever-evolving story of the lands we all love, and we're thrilled to bring it to you. So, Daryl Konufke, thanks again for joining us.
You're very welcome.
So, Daryl, you've been on the SUA board as a board member for roughly 32 years. I was really impressed when I saw that number, added it all up. Tell us about the need for action, the catalyst of SUA's founding. What made SUA come into being in the first place?
Well, I think probably, David, the best explanation of that is Utah virtually demanded that SUA come into being. But I don't want to suggest that we're the ones who discovered the idea of protecting Utah's Red Rock Wilderness. We had people in place on, I guess the saying goes, on whose shoulders we stood. Among them, people like Jim Catlin, an inveterate Sierra Club activist, Ray Wheeler, a heck of a writer, who began to tell the Red Rock story in venues outside of Utah, say, such as High Country News. I got into the game for the best of all possible reasons. It was my job. I went to work for the Wilderness Society in 1985 as the Central Rockies Regional Director. My territory included Colorado, of which I'm a native, and Utah. In the early 80s, a couple of fellows named Clive Kincaid and Robert Weed decided it was time for an organization which had no other purpose, no other axe to grind than the protection of Utah's Red Rock Wilderness. And so they formed the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Some of the early players there were Adele Smith, who lives down in the Springdale area. I got involved. As I say, through my work, it first became a job, then it became a love, and then it sort of became a life. During the heat of the inventory period in the 80s, I was in Utah more often than I was in Colorado. I think my wife had begun to believe that I had a separate family over there. So she started coming with me just to make very, very sure. I think the thing that distinguishes SUA from everybody else who has had a hand and still has a hand in protecting the Red Rock is the unique mission that SUA set for itself. We do only Utah, but we do all of it, and we only do Red Rock Wilderness. There are other organizations that have similarly narrow missions, but I can't think of one which has done it as exceptionally well as SUA has. Does that tell you how we got started?
That's great, Daryl. Thanks for sharing that story. You know, some of those names haven't been heard for a while, and it's great that our listeners can kind of look back on really just a small ragtag group of desert rats that saw the need, which is the classic nonprofit story, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. So, you know, that's a little bit of the background and how SUA got started. What would you say motivates you to stay on the SUA board now? I mean, you had a term as the chairman of the board for quite a while, about 10 years or so. What is it keeps you going? What motivates you?
I think it's important when you get to be as old as I am that you have something outside yourself to dwell upon and to think about and to attend to. Now, that may not be good news for Sue as executive directors, but it fulfills a need in me to do something that matters. And I can't think of a place that matters more than Utah matters. That's another measure, Dave, I think, of the uniqueness of SUA in kind of the global landscape. I hate the word iconic. We've beaten it into meaninglessness. But if there ever was an iconic landscape, it's the Red Rock Country of Utah. Wallace Stegner, who has written about as evocatively about the place as anybody, said that people, every tourist turns into an awestruck worshiper. I plead guilty to that. I mean, it's just an astonishing landscape, and it deserves everything we can do to protect it. I think another thing that matters is the seriousness of the threats, that another thing that keeps us all engaged in doing more than we think we can do. It is the attitude in Utah is one which is perfectly happy to advertise the place with license plates and billboards of delicate arch, but really sets its main goal of turning it all upside down for whatever can be dug from the soil.
Yeah, you know, Daryl, as a grassroots organizer for SUA for many years, I've had the pleasure of, you know, taking our presentations across the country and talking to a wide variety of groups and organizations and peoples that have different interests. And one of the questions they always ask me, which is what I want to pose to you now, is, you know, we talk about the land that draws us in. You got any favorite place in Utah you want to tell us about?
Oh, it's got to be Cedar Mesa. I have spent a fair bit of time there, more than I have, say, in southwestern Utah. And during the first 10 years I was with the Wilderness Society, I led a lot of Wilderness Society members on trips to Cedar Mesa. We would base ourselves at Kenneth Light's Back Creek Ranch. We routinely would do an overfly with Project Lighthawk because of the sheer scope of the wilderness resource in Utah. There's no way in the world you can drive it or walk it on a 3 or 4 day weekend. You can't even do much from the air, but you can at least begin to get some sense of it, the sweep of that country. And then we would go walk on it. And it's a little bit like seeing an elephant skin under a microscope, you know, and then you get down there and see what those wrinkles actually hold. So it's got to be Cedar Mesa, and the Bear's Ears certainly is our latest concern.
Yeah, well put, Daryl. You know, I have actually the same answer, and my experience comes from maybe a little bit different. I started doing service projects down there in Cedar Mesa area in about 1997 and have been going back every year ever since. It has such a draw. And I think that's really what, that feeling is for many conservationists, kind of their entree into the Bear's Ears issue.
Another measure of the power of Utah is the fact that there has grown up around it a sort of Red Rock wilderness literature. I mean, would the Monkey Wrench Gang have been what it was had it been set, say, in Kansas? No offense to Scott Groney, our executive director, who's from Kansas, but I think it's important to remember that he is from Kansas, not in Kansas. So, and then Terry Tempest Williams, who writes as evocatively as anyone about the beauty of that place and its significance in more than just human use terms. It's right to be itself and to be protected because that it's intrinsically valuable. Wallace Stegner's written great, great stuff over the years about the Red Rock Country of Utah. He describes it as a desert such as Christ himself and the apostles might once have walked in. It's unusual. I mean, Alaska is nature on an almost unimaginably grand scale. Some of the coastal stuff. I spent some time in northern Minnesota. The lake country around the Boundary Waters has its own magic, but still I come back to Utah.
So, Daryl, let's talk a little bit more about some of the You know, what do you see over the course of time in Sua's work? What do you think some of the highlights, either the people involved or some of the issues that we've been involved in? What are some of the highlights for you? What moments stand out for you as major milestones or accomplishments of the organization?
Well, you know, over time, the Utah delegation has taken run after run after run at the Red Rock Country, and we have been mostly successful in fending them off. And to say it another way, we've had Sua board members who said, geez, you know, I've been on this board for X number of years and nothing happens. And I say that is a sign that we're doing our job. Because in the present political world, and the one that has existed as far as Utah goes for the last 20 years, I think, anything that is proposed is likely to be bad news for the Red Rock Country. We've discovered over time that the locals have figured they're going to have some wilderness, and they'll give us a little wilderness if at the same time they can take a huge bite out of the idea of wilderness itself. And those are bargains that we have had to resist. Sua has always, I think, prided itself on knowing the difference between a fire in the belly and self-immolation. We don't do what we do just to get a deal. Although I know that in popular parlance, that's all the rage. We do what we do to protect something that's valuable, and by that we mean really protect it. You ask about individuals. You know, we've had a succession of really interesting and very effective people at the helm of Sua, starting with Clive Kincaid, Larry Young, who is, we understand, related to Brother Brigham. That also means for those of us who are non-Mormon, he's probably related to Steve Young, the quarterback. But in any case, great leaders. Scott Groney is a great leader. In that mix is a fellow named Brant Kalkin, who was legendary before he ever came to work with Sua. He came with his friend Susan Touche. We sort of got two for one in that. And Brant led the organization successfully. Led it, I think, in significant ways to what it is today. And that is an organization who knows what it's here to do and throws everything it has at that task. And that goes for the board, it goes for the staff, it goes for our donors. On the subject of, well, we can talk Brant stories if you want, but I want to mention something before I neglect it. We've had some exceptional board members. And I will say right off the bat that I bring down the average. But among the best is a guy named Bert Fingerhut. Bert Fingerhut introduced the Utah story to people that he knew from his growing up and working in New York City before he came west and vowed to sleep on the ground 100 and some days a year or some such crazy thing. And he attracted people to our board like Hans Jörg Wiese, who has been enormously generous with us. A guy who has a lot of irons in the fire, but he never tires of his support for the Red Rock Country.
Well, those are, of course, names that ring true to so many of us. You know, you talked about some of these early folks and what they've meant and, you know, how bringing the issue nationally, you know, to everybody's attention in the country has really, you know, kept us going and is really what keeps us thriving. But, you know, looking back at some of these times, has there ever, in your opinion, been as big of a threat as what we're seeing right now, kind of into the present day with the administration and taking aim on Utah wilderness like it's done over the last couple of years?
Well, you know, that's kind of a tough one, which is not, as you might expect, a way for me to dodge the question. We've had some real challenges. The wilderness inventory itself was a challenge, and we came out eventually on top in that fight. The inventory, which was ordered by FLTMA, Federal Land Policy Management Act of 76? Yeah. Directed the BLM to go out and determine how much wilderness there actually was on the lands that it managed. Well, I think that the BLM in the main decided to eliminate as much wilderness as possible. Meanwhile, we were clamoring and doing our own inventories, a thing of which we got much better over the years, to show that they were full of beans and that we were right. We knew the ground better than they did, and we brought that evidence to light. The Watt years were a challenge. Gail Norton was a challenge with her No More Wilderness deal. We've managed to outlive most of those, but I don't know when I've ever seen threats arrayed as they are right now. I think this is a difficult time, goodness knows, for the world, but also for Sioux and the Red Rock country. I also believe we're up to the challenge.
Yeah, and we're living that challenge every day, and it's because of people who are in our listening audience, everyday folks who are getting involved in these campaigns. That's how these lands are going to continue to be protected, and that's how we're going to ultimately get to where we want to be, which is kind of where I'd like to go with this next question, kind of to summarize our conversation here. You have a broad perspective of Sioux in the past and in the current situations we're in. What do you think the future looks like for Sioux and for the Utah Wilderness Movement? Are we still going to be doing this in another 30 years? Are we still going to be relevant? Are we still going to be needed? What's your thoughts on that, Darrell?
Well, let me quote a fellow named Brant Kalkin about that. The wilderness estate in this country, in the United States, in its landmass, 5 or 6%. Most of the rest, has, in pure wilderness terms, has been lost to development. People would ask Brant Kalkin, what do you want? And he'd say, I want everything that's left. You got 90%, we'll take the last 10. That's kind of where I think we are. But I also am not naive. I think that Utah politicians, principally the county types in southern Utah, who are a tiny percentage of the total, incidentally, but are deferred to in shameless ways by the all the statewide elected politicians, they're not going to give up trying to make sure there is no wilderness. In fact, I think their goal goes way beyond that. They want to make damn sure that there is no public land in Utah. And that, I think, is maybe evidenced best by the RS-2477, the Phantom Roads campaign. The state has filed thousands upon thousands upon thousands of miles of claims, which, if they win, will give them control over the land. And this, finally, is not about transportation, Dave, as you perfectly well know from your time in the field. This is about defeating wilderness before it ever gets a chance to take a breath. So, yeah, we're going to be relevant. I don't have any illusions that we're going to win this in the next 10 or 20 years. And I don't have any illusions either that Utah is going to continue to work its magic on people. If I had to go back to a thing, one thing, one event, one notion that brought the fight to where it is today, it's the idea of making Utah and its Red Rock country important to more than just Utahns. I think that was the work of Clive Kincaid. We were, Clive too, but Brant Kalkin. We were told by some of the gurus from the national groups, and I guess I sort of include my own, the Wilderness Society, in this, that there's, you can't have a national campaign. You've got to win it at the state level, which means you got to get both senators behind it or it'll never clear the Senate. You might roll somebody in the House, but you will not roll them in the Senate. We've never done it on a major wilderness bill, but we've done it in a lot of small ways, and I think we can continue to do that.
Well, on that uplifting note, I agree. I mean, that's why I stay in this, Darrell. And I got to say that, you're a big reason why I'm still here and still fighting. From when I first met you way back in 1991, I believe it was, I saw the spirit that you carried. And I want you to know that spirit carries over with the Sioux staff today. I mean, you certainly are an inspiration. We really appreciate you taking time to discuss some of the important events and this cast of colorful characters in Sioux's history with us today. We certainly put you in the center of that cast. And
you're very kind to say so. And if I didn't mention what I'm about to mention, I would be A, remiss, and B, homeless. My first exposure to the canyon country was through my wife. We met in Washington. We had a week, and I said, let's go to the Rockies, and she said, let's go to Utah. My response was, why? Well, I soon found out. She took me into Grand Gulch, and I was blown away and remained so. So you can thank my wife.
I will, that's for sure, and we all will. Well, thanks again, Darrell. We appreciate you joining us. And
you're welcome, Dave. Thank you.
Yes, we're deeply grateful to your contribution to this cause.
Thanks for all you do for the Red Rock.
In our next episode, we'll bring you up to date on congressional action affecting 1.5 million acres of wildlands in Emery County, Utah, including the magnificent San Rafael Swell, Muddy Creek, and Labyrinth Canyons. Wild Utah is made possible by the contributing members of SUA. Our theme music is written and performed in Moab by Haley Noel Austin. Our producer is Jerry Schmidt. Wild Utah is recorded at the studios of KRCL 90.9 FM, Listeners Community Radio of Utah, in Salt Lake City. Stay informed about current events at SUA. Visit us at sua.org and click on Get Involved to discover how you can join the movement to protect Wild Utah. To receive information and alerts via text message, text the word Utah to 52886. That's the word Utah to the number 52886. Follow the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance on Facebook, on Instagram at Protect Wild Utah, and on Twitter at Southern UT Wild. And be sure to subscribe to the Wild Utah podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or your favorite podcast app. Visit sua.org/podcast for additional ways to subscribe. On behalf of SUA, I'm Dave Pacheco. Thanks for listening to Wild Utah. We hope you can join us next time.